Hello, I'm Tom Edwards. Welcome to this special episode of The Big Interview. Over the past three seasons, we've spoken to some of the greatest minds in business, the arts, politics, design, and more. This week, we're looking back through the archive at an industry which, here at Midori House and throughout our bureau, we see as having a most profound impact on the world in which we live. The architects, together with urban planners, are one of the key forces, often invisible, behind our everyday lives, from our workspaces to the train stations and airports we use to get around, to the memorials and public spaces where we take time to contemplate or relax. We expect our surroundings to be everything: practical, innovative, functional, stylish, affordable, and more. It can be a tough brief. The Big Interview has spoken to some of the very best in the business to find out exactly how to go from concept to design to finished project. So let's hear it for the architects. We kick things off with perhaps one of the most innovative and revered players in the game. Norman Foster, with Foster & Partners, has overseen, amongst so many celebrated others, huge glass and steel structures like the Gherkin here in London and Beijing's International Airport Terminal, about which he spoke with our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé.
Well, first of all, you're making huge sacrifices. You have to move quickly. I mean, when we did Beijing Airport, we had to mobilize and get a very, very large team into Beijing, into a hotel. The hotel was taken over. The other disciplines came. Everybody had to work through Christmas. March, 3 months later, we started on site with enough contract documentation to start the process running. And so it is being responsive and at the same time also bringing in experts to question and to challenge and to say, are you absolutely sure that your brief is right? It depends on the city. It depends on the economy. In some cases, they've done their homework to an extraordinary degree. The chances are they have experts who know every airport in the world, have analyzed it. In other cases, they need help, they need audit, they need cross-checking, questioning. So it's getting that balance between being an advocate, an audit, challenging, questioning, but at the same time, having that, sharing that can-do mentality. Mm. I remember on Beijing, all the major meetings with the airport board had been held in our hotel. When it was obvious that we were going to finish ahead of time, the last major meeting, we were called to have the dinner at the leader of the project at his place. And his place was the works canteen. And he had lived the project. This is a man called Commander Chen, and he lived the project there.
He was on site in a prefab hut or something.
He lived on the site. He didn't even take Chinese New Year to see his family during the duration of the project. He lived the project. And on the building site, there were these huge red banners. And on the way out, I asked the young man who interpreted, Eric, and I said something like, as we walked out, these banners in the canteen, they look like the banners on the building site in the building. And he said, yes. I said, what do they say? Well, on this side, it says, if you're afraid of death, you cannot be a member of the Communist Party. And I said, and what does it say on the other side? If you're a member of the airport team, you cannot be afraid of hardship. And we were the only survivors as architects on that project. And that, I believe, is because we shared that ethic. We lived the project 7 days, 24 hours.
On a project like that, when you think of the commander living on site, is there a certain ambition on his side, or is he living the ambition of the leadership, do you think?
It's very difficult to say. My own opinion, and it's only an opinion, is that it's seamless, that in between our visits, visits were made to that site at the highest level of authority, because words would come down about standards, about whether it was reflecting the right values. But there was, you know, there was a dialogue. And this individual lived the project and cared for the project and so was concerned that the bathrooms were not high enough quality. There should be stone, shouldn't be plastic. I mean, this was, I felt it was seamless. Of course, it was tough. It was difficult. It's much more difficult in many ways than doing a project in, but they're extraordinary. I mean, that building was made there, apart from one or two specialist systems. That's a major transition. I mean, when we won the Hong Kong Bank project in 1979, everything was shipped in. Beijing Airport, everything, except the very specialized baggage systems, of which there are only one or two companies in the world, and they almost a monopoly. Mm-hmm. Everything else was made in China.
That was Norman Foster in conversation with Tyler Brulé. From the vast, imposing structures of Foster and Partners to the more serene works of Daniel Libeskind, perhaps best known for the Jewish Museum in Berlin and for being master planner for New York's Ground Zero, Libeskind creates spaces in which people should feel solemn, places to remember the past. He spoke to Steve Bloomfield about his own past and where he calls home.
You know, my home is in New York, but I also live in Milan. I also, you know, consider Berlin my home. You know, the air is my home as well, because I'm so much in the air going, you know, from Africa to Asia to South America, back home to New York. So, but, you know, home is really New York.
So where would you say that you're from?
Well, you know, where am I from? I was an immigrant several times. I was born in Poland. I lived in Israel, live in New York. We moved 18 times across the oceans with our children, not as tourists, but, you know, we lived in Italy, we lived in England, we lived in Helsinki, we lived in Canada, we lived in Detroit, we lived in LA, we lived in Paris. I don't know, we lived in so many places that it's hard to say, where are you from? You're from the world.
And is that, do you think you've moved that many times because you come from Poland, you were born in Poland after the Second World War? As a Jew growing up in Poland after the Second World War, it must have been a very strange place. I notice you don't necessarily say you're Polish.
You know, I used to not say Polish because I grew up under tremendous oppression, communism, anti-Semitism, a deadly combination. But when I have returned to Poland, and I have been there many times, and now I'm building, you know, the tallest residential tower in Warsaw, I consider myself Polish again, because Poland is so different from the Poland that I left. So the world is interesting because it changes and it transforms itself. And you can never just say it's the past, because the past continues to grow into the future.
Do you still feel then some affinity for Poland now that you perhaps didn't when you were growing up?
Oh, absolutely. Well, many Polish things have been deep in my heart, from Polish music to Polish literature. I read Polish. I speak Polish. So it is my country. It is my home. But, you know, it has been transformed in time, you know, from times of oppression. After the Holocaust, my parents were survivors. Living in the 40s, 50s in Poland was not pleasant. And we were, you know, lucky to be let out when the Iron Curtain sort of cracked. And Jews were kind of expelled to Israel. So we were in Israel for a while. And then we wound up in New York. So I always say I had two promised lands.
What do you remember from your childhood now? And do you ever really actually think much about when you were young?
I don't really think much about it. I'm not a nostalgic person, but certainly it has colored my perception of the world. You know, the grayness of Poland and the conformity contrasted with the blue skies of the Mediterranean in Tel Aviv, and then with the amazing vistas of New York and the Bronx, where I wound up. That does form a sort of a composition in my mind, a musical structure, which is like a continuo, basso continuo, you know, in a Baroque piece of music.
You mentioned that you've had two promised lands. Let's talk about that first, Israel, because many Jews who grew up in Europe move to Israel or have moved to Israel, and then they stay there. They feel that they are finally home. Did you not feel that?
You know, it was not my decision to make. It was my parents. But my parents kind of disagreed. My father was very much a sort of socially minded person. He wanted to live on the kibbutz. So we were on the kibbutz for a while. My mother, who was kind of an anarchic personality and an entrepreneur in her own way, did not like the kibbutz where she had a sister. It was difficult to get a job. Israel was a young country. It was just a few years old. So my parents decided, my father, that he would come to America. He had his only a surviving sister who survived Auschwitz, and he was determined to come to America, and so we did.
Were you ever tempted to, once you were in America, were you ever tempted to go back to Israel to make that the sort of the family home again?
No, not really. I mean, I've been back, and I am always back. But you know, to me, it's like continuity in New York. You know, which is the capital where Jewish people are at home more? Is it Tel Aviv or New York? Probably New York.
So, what's your relationship like with Israel? Because for every Jew, there is a relationship with Israel, which is verges from the incredibly weak and threadbare to the incredibly strong. Where do you stand on it?
No, I love Israel. I have the family in Israel represents the whole of, I would say, Jewishness. On one hand, you have the Chalutzim. People came to Palestine to create, you know, roads, and were committed to socialists and democratic socialists who worked in the soil, who were intellectuals, who read Marx and Freud and so on. On the other hand, my cousins are the Mea Shearim and Bnei Barak. They are the ultra, ultra, ultra religious with the peyot and with the huge fur hats. So, you know, I do love Israel. And it's a complicated country, but of course, it's a country that is also kind of a fantastic vision of possibilities. And when we came from Poland to Israel, I was so shocked when we said, "Look, there's a policeman. He's Jewish. There's a thief. He's Jewish. There's somebody washing a car. They're all Jews." It was the strangest thing because we didn't think Jews did those things.
Your time in New York, you went there when you're still very young. What was it about New York that made you feel this is my second promised land?
It was very easy because we moved to the Bronx. I spoke no English. We spoke no language. My parents were factory workers. We didn't have any money. We didn't know anybody outside of my aunt who lived in Pennsylvania and was hardly really alive. She was a survivor, but she was like the ghosts of the survival. But I fell in love with New York. All of us did because, you know, we lived in a neighborhood that had Jewish people, had Italians, had African-Americans, had Irish. Right away, you had that sense of being welcomed into this amazing melting pot. And it's not really a cliche because all my friends, I mean, my friend who taught me English was an Italian guy. I mean, his parents had just come from Italy. He spoke English better than I did. But I remember, you know, Tony giving me the words. I would say, you know, "What is that? Table. What is that? A cup." So, you know, being an immigrant to America was something memorable because people welcomed us. And it was strange. We didn't speak, but people smiled. They patted us on the head. They were friendly. They were not people who seemed alien to us. Even though they look different, we never saw people like that in our lives before. So yes, America, I think, as I experienced it, was the homeland for immigrants, was free for, you know, to welcome the immigrants, just as it said on the Statue of Liberty by Emma Lazarus, you know, "Give me the poor, the tired, give me the rejects of the world. Come here. This is the place where you can breathe free." And I certainly was breathing free when I came to New York.
Daniel Libeskind talking to Monocle's Steve Bloomfield. Now, as any business owner knows, the first few months, the first few projects can make or break the company. Amanda Levitt sat down with Sophie Grove to talk about starting out at Future Systems and the risks taken when designing the Sterling Prize-winning Lords Media Centre here in London.
You know, the very nature of architecture is about risk-taking because every building is, in a sense, bespoke. And with bespoke and the one-off comes risk. And yet there's a paradox that everybody wants that, but they want it to be risk-free. And it's just simply not possible. So it's about how do you manage those risks. And because we were so obsessed with this project, we managed to contain all those things and with the engineers Arup to resolve the very challenging structural kind of hurdles that we put in front of ourselves, if you like. The risk that we hadn't really understood was the risk of simply focusing on this one project. Because, and we believed that, you know, when it was finished, that everybody would want another one, that somehow the commissions would roll in. It didn't happen. And because we had focused on this building so closely and forgotten to look for other work, we were on the verge of bankruptcy at the end of that project. And had we not won the Sterling Prize, which also at that time came with a cheque of £20,000, we would probably have gone under.
You've taken on this sort of strategic, intuitive, but very experimental approach with materials particularly. I mean, the word holistic is definitely overused, but it does apply to your practice because you tackle big projects like this beautiful porcelain courtyard, but also smaller restaurants, even the tin can. And then globally, a project like the Central Embassy in Bangkok. I wondered whether or not you could give an insight into how you go about choosing your forms, your inspiration. And a lot of people would sort of like to get behind the initial sort of creative process that goes into generating these buildings. Could you sort of unpick sort of how ALA works in that way?
In a way, you know, form for us is the result of the thinking, result of the questions that we ask ourselves, that we ask the client, that we ask of the site. It's a result of the research that we do. It's a result of the narrative that we develop to help drive a project, to help describe it. There's not a formula.
There's no sketch on the back of an envelope.
No, it doesn't. And I, you know, it really comes out of a much more complex line of inquiry. And so, you know, to give an example, the V&A and the structure of the roof of the gallery, which is this folded plate, comes out of, first of all, the technical challenge of spanning 38 metres, but also came out of a desire to want to express that challenge. So we could easily have created a white box or a black box without any expression to the ceiling, but that is not the nature of the V&A. The V&A is a very didactic institution. It's didactic in its mission, in its collection, and in its building, in the building itself. And we wanted to continue that tradition and to make the structure be explicit of the job it was doing, and then kind of follow in the tradition of the sort of ornate neoclassic, neo-Gothic ceilings, museological ceilings that is the V&A. And then something like the porcelain courtyard came about because we wanted to reflect that structure. We wanted to, for the courtyard to in some way be an expression of the kind of palpable energy of what was below. And that was a much more kind of finessed approach and wanting to explore materials and particularly porcelain, although we didn't set out to use porcelain, and then to somehow push a material to its limits and express that in the way that we've conceived of the courtyard.
Amanda Levitt and Sophie Grove in conversation. Now, some might say that designing a bus doesn't count as architecture. Thomas Heatherwick, behind the relaunch of the iconic Routemaster, would probably disagree. The London-based designer, behind some visionary projects in the British public realm, sat down with Monocle's editor Andrew Tuck to explain the importance of thoughtful and friendly urban infrastructure.
I'm interested in gaps. I was brought up in Wood Green and would go to school in Muswell Hill. I would get a bus every day there and back, and I watched the gradual erosion of the clarity of Transport for London, or London Transport as it was then called, over years, as the sort of funny shifting of priorities. And then you were there travelling over time to other parts of the world, and you'd meet someone who said, I'm coming to London and I can't wait to go on the red double-decker bus. And you found yourself cringing and thinking, don't actually, because even though London is famous for its red double-decker buses, the human experience had been suppressed for the apparent efficiency of the bus timetabling, and the bus system had really become the poor relative to the underground system that we have here in London. And you could see, as the Routemaster bus, which was the bus that is romantic in people's minds, had been gradually reduced and reduced, so there's just a tiny handful on the streets of London. That bus was designed 55 years ago. And in the intervening years, there'd been no design team given the chance to design this piece of infrastructure specifically for London. And society and London had changed. And we wanted mummies with buggies to be able to get onto buses. And we needed a bus with not just one door, but three. And having two staircases, again, would allow loading and unloading times to be better. And we also wanted a bus that would use 40% less energy than the existing buses. But then, as someone who can't help but wonder why everything is like it is around you, the buses in recent times, you'd sit in the back of one of the buses at the top and you'd just look out And like a sort of design archaeologist, your eyes would roam around wondering at the cacophony of outcome that was there. So you could see that there had been a regulation that had come in maybe 15 years ago saying there must be a contrast level between the hand poles and the surrounding environment. And you could see there was no calming, coordinating role of a design team for more than half a century. And so their hand poles had become nuclear warning yellow because someone had gone, you want contrast? I'll give you contrast. And suddenly they're nuclear warning yellow. But you can achieve a contrast without having the most jarring thing on your eyeballs. And you could see that the light levels, that there was an imperative to have a particular lumen level or lux level for seating areas and for the walking areas. And you could see someone said, you want more light? I'll give you more light. And suddenly there's fluorescent tubes, the same as in a battery chicken farm. So it seemed that there were things that in the world of interior design were very common. Lighting that is warm on human skin and without needing fluorescent tubes that with cold temperature of light, and a calibration of materials. And there were these arbitrary decisions that had happened. You know, suddenly all the fiberglass was purple and then the seats were blue with yellow spots on. You think, why did that happen? But there was no role just bringing all of those things together. And I found it fascinating, and still do, the blind spots we have at seeing the world around us. And if you were going to build a new building in London, a two-story building in the centre of London somewhere, the process of consultation with the council you'd need to go through to get planning permission, also consultation with, for example, the Commission for Architecture and the Built Environment, who would be looking at how does something fit in with its historical context. But if it's a two-story building on wheels, there's no such constraint. The only thing is it red? And there happen to be 7,000 of them. So you're more likely to see the elevation of a red double-decker bus than any building. But it was because it's called infrastructure, it's seen differently. And we've found that with power station we've worked on, with car parks, so many things. There are these funny ways we perceive them. And our focus has been, in a way, on human dignity, particularly with, sounds a pompous word, but with buses. If you had a very expensive Ferrari or something and someone was driving around London, fine. But you can't get a better view of London than the front at the top of a double-decker bus. And why couldn't that environment sort of nurture that? The only thing we weren't able to do is get opening windows. That's my one frustration. Transport for London were adamant that they weren't having opening windows.
Thomas Heatherwick and Andrew Tuck there. Another architect with a focus on practicality and usability is Kevin Roach. The Irish-American's been known to interview hundreds of people before he even starts his designs to find out exactly how his buildings will be used. Steve Bloomfield went to meet Roach, who told him how he left his homeland to move to New York City to work with the legendary designer Mies van der Rohe.
I decided to study with Mies van der Rohe and with another member from the office in Dublin. We both went. We applied to Yale, Harvard and IIT, where Mies was, and incredibly we were accepted at all three of them. I couldn't believe it. But in any case, we flew to Chicago. When we arrived at Chicago, and in the car, the taxi going into the city, there was a song from a funeral home, they were selling funeral home services, and there was this very lively song. And we looked at each other and said, boy, what did we get into here? But then we got to the school, and Mies was absolutely wonderful. He never spoke about things very much, but you kind of, the aura of the seriousness of architecture was very important and was very good.
But was he difficult to work with?
He was not difficult, he was austere. And one of the first projects that we had was to design a house. Now, it had been snowing heavily in Chicago, so the house I designed had a pitched roof on it, which seemed like what the Scandinavians did. They would throw, of course, in the Bauhaus tradition, you simply didn't do a pitched roof. So I presented my pitched roof house to Mies, and he looked at it for a little while, and then he said, you could do that, but I would not do that, you know. And that was the only instruction I got from him. the entire session I had there. So after I kind of ran out of money, after the first term, decided to hell with it, the United Nations had just been formed, and I was absolutely wanted to contribute some way to the United Nations of the world. And the building in New York was just about to start construction. And I thought, I can go and I can help, I can do something. So I got on a bus and went with my last few dollars to New York and went and begged them at the office, the architectural office, to hire me. And they did. They hired me as a file clerk, even though I'd had many years of practicing as an architect.
But you were quite happy to go
for
that
job. I really wanted to do it. So I started there as a file clerk. But after a few months, they put me on the drawings. And one of the things I had was detailing the end marble walls on the Secretariat building. And I'm always astonished when I drive down into New York and I see this, because they're still there, because I didn't know what the hell I was doing. And I had no idea how to detail them attached to the marble. But obviously somebody else must have got hold of it farther on down there. But it was a great experience.
You talk about what it meant to you to be part of the UM project. Do you feel that your architecture is about sort of, you know, the impact that you can have on the world, not just on making a great building?
Well, I finally came to the realization, not quite just then, but gradually over the years, that what is the purpose of architecture? What is the purpose? And I realized that it has to be, and it should be, a commitment on the part of the individual to devote their lives to trying to improve in some way the built environment, the living environment, the environment for business, the environment for recreation, the environment for worship, if we're going to do that, that it has a special characteristic, and it is important that that is not just a piece of sculpture. It's important that it is, and I'm not just talking about function, I'm talking about the aura that it has.
Kevin Roach and Steve Bloomfield there. That brings us to the end of a special episode of The Big Interview with me, Tom Edwards. The show's produced and edited by Bill Luty and researched by Gaia Lutz. Don't forget to subscribe to it or any of our other programmes on Monocle 24. Find them at iTunes, SoundCloud, at monocle.com or on your preferred platform. Until next time, that's all we've got time for on The Big Interview. Thanks very much for listening.